Meeting Points. Meeting Points. Another week has gone by, and here we are with another guest. It is with great pleasure that I welcome the USA Ambassador to Malta, Ms. Molly Bordenaro, at the unassuming and modest studios of Campus FM for the program Meeting Points. During this program, I hope to engage not only with the role that the Ambassador has in Malta, but I am also very interested in touching base with the conceptions and possible misconceptions that we may hold towards the USA. Ms. Bordenaro comes from Portland, Oregon, which, to my understanding, is even bigger than Malta as far as population and probably even as far as the area is concerned. She has been involved in the business community through real estate and finance, but has always had this link with politics. We must also add that Ms. Bordenaro is the mother of three children, and juggling all of this must be quite a job, I would imagine. So I would like to welcome you to our radio show. Who is Ambassador Bordenaro, both on a personal and professional level? Because some may think, and probably I was one of those, that the ambassador is more or less a token appointment. So I would like to have your impression on this.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the radio program today. It's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to be able to speak via your program to as many of the Maltese as possible. To address your first question, I guess I'll mention firstly that it's definitely not a token appointment in terms of serving as ambassador. The United States of America reserves the ability for the President of the United States to choose ambassadors and personally appoint them. And so President Bush put in a very much amount of serious thought. He did a great job, I think, with the ambassadors we have around the world right now of really looking at ways of matching the right person to each country. And I'm, like all the other ambassadors serving the United States right now, pleased and proud to do so, but extremely dedicated to articulate the positions of the United States, to speak to the Maltese people in general, to allow them an opportunity to get to know more about American culture, but also to listen to people. So much part of my job is really getting out there and getting to know the Maltese and listening to them as well. And of course, the primary responsibility of representing the United States to the Maltese government and forging an even stronger relationship mm-hmm. between our two countries.
Okay, it seems like a lifetime in a way, but you have just been ambassador since September 2005. That's very little time. However, I believe you are very much a popular ambassador, as you've just mentioned. Where you engage continually and almost strategically in open debates with students in the media at university, is this American USA ambassador policy, or is it Molly Bordenaro policy? Because we've had other American ambassadors here, so
no,
they weren't so visible.
There's definitely a concerted effort on the part of the United States vis-a-vis our diplomats and ambassadors serving around the world to reach out more to the general public. Of course, as I said before, we also work on the government-to-government basis between the relationship to our two countries. But more and more, the United States is putting a premium and feels the importance of working directly with the general public, in this case in Malta. Mm-hmm. And in particular, our embassy here has focused a lot on younger people and university students mm-hmm. and even students at younger ages because we feel it's so important to talk about and to to be a part of the education process about the global community, about who the United States is as a country, what we stand for, to dispel a lot of misconceptions that exist about the United States. And I also have a particular passion in reaching out to young people. As you said before, I'm a mom of three young kids, and I just feel that where we can add value in terms of their educational growth of about the global community in the United States, that I very much like to do that. And I love the energy of young people as well.
Excellent. Did you know the Republic of Malta before you were appointed ambassador?
I did. In fact,
you did.
Yes, I did. And this is where President Bush really made a concerted effort to make personal matches with the right countries, not just in terms of the skill sets of the individuals, but also if there were any type of familial or cultural ties. And actually, my husband is first-generation American. His father is Sicilian, was born in Sicily. So this part of the Mediterranean is very close to our hearts. We used to come here from the United States to Sicily in particular about every few years to visit his close relatives and cousins and aunts and uncles. And actually, one of his uncles is married to a Maltese.
Oh, really?
And she became one of my closest friends over the years. And through her, got to know a lot about the wonderful history and culture of Malta. And so by marriage, we are related to Maltese. And when President Bush first asked me to serve as ambassador, he knew that my husband was from Sicily and knew that we had relations by marriage to Maltese as well. So
okay. So as I said in the beginning, you come from the business sector. You end up immersed in a very political role within a very smaller country than yours. Was this a cultural shock for you? How did it affect you? Did it affect you personally and maybe on a family basis?
It was definitely not a cultural shock. I mean, it was a wonderful opportunity that we were very much looking forward to being able to live here. And as I said before, we're familiar with the Mediterranean area. But we were very much looking forward to living here and being a part of Maltese culture. And it's been an amazing 2 years. I can't believe how fast it's gone by. When we arrived here, our youngest child was just 5 months old. And she's now almost 2.5. And so she is more Maltese than American at this point in terms of the length of time she's spent here in Malta versus the United States. And so it's been a great experience for our family. Our children are going to a Maltese school. Their friends are all Maltese. We have so many Maltese friends. It has been an absolutely enjoyable experience. And then in terms of taking on the role of ambassador, that was an easy transition in terms of the fact that I feel very proud and honored to be able to represent the United States and feel very strongly about the good values that the United States stands for, the values of freedom and liberty and justice and of human rights and equality for all people. And at the heart, that's what the United States stands for. And so it was very easy to step into a role where I get to espouse those fundamental values and in some part contribute to the world becoming a more democratic, freer place as well.
We'll catch up on that later on, because that's a very interesting area that you've just mentioned. On the celebration of the 4th of July, Independence Day last year, but apparently because of World Cup and all this, you couldn't do it actually on the 4th day. You had a reception, and during this reception, you hosted, you spoke, amongst other things, on the relationship that there has been between the USA and Malta for much longer than most of us knew about. So there's this relationship between the USA and Malta embedded in history. Can you tell us a bit about that, the relationship that Malta had with Franklin and with...
Right. Absolutely. In fact, the United States and Malta have had a long historical relationship that dates back to the early 1700s, when the United States itself was just becoming a country. I think two of the most prominent examples of how intertwined our two countries are was, first of all, when the United States was fighting to gain its own independence in 1776, the Maltese lent about 1,800 Maltese sailors, which at the time were with the Knights, to help fight for our independence. And they joined the French and aided the young United States revolutionaries in eventually gaining independence. And this was so the United States was so grateful for the role that Malta played in helping us gain our independence that when the government was first formed and Benjamin Franklin became the first treasurer, he minted a coin. And one of the first coins he gave was to the Grand Master at the time, Grand Master de Rohan, to express appreciation for Malta's role in our own independence.
Sure, interesting.
And then, of course, soon after that, America was having trouble with our ships crossing through for commerce in the Mediterranean. And a lot of the Mediterranean was being besieged by the Barbary pirates at the time. And so the United States sent its actual Marines at the time, our first Marines, down to try to keep the Mediterranean safe and secure. And we actually worked with Malta to help push back the Barbary pirates so that real commerce and safe commerce could go through the Mediterranean. This was probably the first place where the United States and Malta really worked together, in particular, on Mediterranean security and safety.
It's really interesting. I didn't get that in my history lesson. It must have been either the teacher or me having an app problem. I don't. Anyway, you've already touched obviously upon this, but how would you describe USA, Ms. Bordenaroe? It's at times it's difficult trying to understand your nation in the sense that it features in media. Continuously, it features in foreign policy, continuously, it features in showbiz. It's idiosyncratic, it's peculiar, and it's distinctive. Somehow, people are either extraordinarily fascinated by your country, or else somehow they are reviled towards your country. What do you make of this? Why does this happen, all this hullabaloo?
Well, as I was saying earlier, part of my role in going out and speaking to people is to try to present a more realistic picture of what the United States is, because Hollywood is not a true reflection of the United States. Mm-hmm. It is movies. It's pretend. It's media. It's make believe. And so, while it is part of the culture, it is a very small part of the overall real culture of the United States. And when you come to the United States, you get a real tangible feel for a sense of community all across the United States. There's communities and towns and states that really work together, that are very family-oriented, that are built by neighborhoods after neighborhoods, built around schools, that really share many of the same values as people all around the world, including people here in Malta, about wanting to have as much opportunity as possible, to have a good life, to have good health care, to have good education for their children, and to be able to live in a safe neighborhood. And that exists in the United States. And it's wonderful when you are able to get out to see the rural areas and the towns and even the cities. And of course, like every country, we do have problems. But as a mature democracy, we're able to address our problems fast. We're able to have good debate on them, an open debate, and to find real solutions to the problems. And I think one of the things that is really distinct about the United States is that anyone who is in America, especially as a young person, there is such a sense of hope and optimism in terms of your own future, and a real sense of the fact that there is general equality and freedom to choose whatever you want to do, freedom to be whatever you want to do, and freedom to change who you are throughout your life. As a young person, you can choose what you want to study, what you want to do. There's tremendous opportunity. There aren't barriers regulating that. But even as a young adult, you could switch careers or change. Or in the case of my own family, where we made a decision after having children that my husband would stay home with the kids, mm-hmm. and that because of where my career was, that I would be the one that would work at the time. Now that may switch when we go back. He may be the one that's in working, and I may be the one to stay home. But the most important thing is that in the United States, we felt both culturally acceptable, politically acceptable, career-wise acceptable, to make that decision of what was in our family's best interest without any other outside cultural, political influences, and to have the flexibility and freedom to make those decisions to really raise your family the best way possible.
Okay. You have mentioned President George Bush, and he's considered as the most powerful person on the planet. However, his popularity in the States and the international scene seems to be plummeting. Ambassador Bolton, what do you make of all this? Do you share the decisions he makes in certain areas like foreign policy, military engagement, homeland security?
As ambassador representing the United States of America, I definitely absolutely share his positions on foreign policy. I also happen to know him personally, and he is a wonderful individual who is a human being filled with compassion and caring, and cares very deeply about the American people and also people throughout the world. Human rights is probably one of his areas where he is most passionate, most concerned about. That's probably why he has quadrupled aid to, for instance, Africa during his tenure as President of the United States. And he just pledged $30 billion to help relieve HIV and malaria in the African continent. And this has driven a lot of his decisions of why he feels it's important to help people be able to be free from oppressive, brutal regimes. And I am very pleased with what he's done to help women around the world, whether it's in Afghanistan or in other places, where prior to removing the Taliban, women were not even allowed to go to school or be educated or leave their homes without permission, or many times were stoned to death without any type of fair trial if their husbands thought that they were unfaithful or for whatever reason. And that's being changed where women around the world are now having equality. So he is such a personal believer in human rights. The one thing that President Bush, I personally know, does not follow is the popularity ratings in the polls. And that's refreshing to have a leader who's not trying to make decisions based on whether or not it's popular, but based on whether or not it's right. And for that reason, he is a real leader.
I'd like to pick up on this aspect of President Bush. It's true. It's great to have a leader who's not after popularity ratings. However, I think democracy is made by popularity, by people. So isn't it worrying as well that certain decisions are being taken even if the country he represents and the values he stands for are somehow not getting through to the people? I don't know if I'm clear on this, because it's okay not to be popular, because you have to do certain decisions, that's fair enough. But on the other hand, people, through the lack of popularity, I'm saying even within the United States, it's an indication that they are not favoring, possibly, what he's doing or certain decisions he's taking. For example, the extended stay in Iraq, and the possibly over-involvement in other places and other countries in the world where he is, where he felt that engaging in a military way is the best way of doing it. I don't know if you And that's,
well, the United States has such a strong, vigorous democracy. In fact, we have three distinct branches of government, where the Congress, which faces election through the House of Representatives every 2 years, every single member of the House of Representatives is up for election every 2 years. And then the executive branch, which is the president, which is up for election every 2 years. I mean, every 4 years. And President Bush was just elected 2.5 years ago, reelected. And then the judicial branch. So we have, through our democratic system of being able to vote often, to be able to allow the American people to be empowered to make the decisions of who their leaders are going to be, and then elect them to make these decisions. Now, it's very dangerous if you have a leader who's just looking at popular polls. The leaders are elected to make these decisions and many times have information or working that is not necessarily always instantaneously available to the American public. But through this very strong democratic system, there's always room for debate. There's room for the public to dissent. There's room for active public debate. And that plays a part in the fact that every 2 years we have an election where new leaders can be chosen, or every 4 years at the executive branch level. But that doesn't take away from the fact that President Bush or whoever the president of the United States is still needs to make very important decisions about where's the best way to spend the United States resources, what social programs or taxes in the United States, or when it comes to international policy, working multilaterally with countries around the world, either through the United Nations or through transatlantic partnerships like the EU, or, for instance, the Quartet, which is working on the Middle East peace process with the UN and Russia and the EU, working to make very solid decisions on trying to do the best thing for peace and security around the world.
Okay. The USA embraces, as you obviously said, and I knew, I definitely agree with you, embraces and cuddles close to its heart the notion of civil rights and civil rights movements. And yet we still get instances of racism in the States, what is interpreted as unfair and unreasonable incarceration, like Guantanamo Bay, abortion, capital punishment. What do you think about this? I mean, is this, you know, I mean, how come such a country which embraces such values and yet seems to be struggling on these areas?
Well, let me get back to the issue of Guantanamo Bay and address the larger part of your question first. First of all, I am so proud of the United States of America as a country in terms of its stance on racism and equality. Mm-hmm. I really think that when it comes to the majority of the population and society as a whole, it is a society that is very egalitarian and that racism is not tolerated. It is not tolerated within academic, private sector, public sector, and it is heavily punished if racism does exist through certain laws or through our court system. And so we value that, and it's something that really defines who the United States is as a country. In terms of the other issues that you mentioned, abortion and the death penalty, these are issues that are being debated and discussed on a continual basis within the United States. Actually, those two issues are made by individual states, and some of our states don't have death penalties. Mm. Some of our states right now are debating on trying to put certain limits in place on certain types of abortions. And so, once again, in a very mature, active democracy, the ability to debate these, and in a federalist system, certain states can make decisions without the federal government to make those particular issues that you brought up either how to address them as a society. Now let me get to Guantanamo Bay, because here's where I think there's tremendous misconceptions. I mean, President Bush himself has said that they are working hard to close Guantanamo Bay. They've opened it up to third-party organizations like the International Red Cross, and there's actual verification from these third-party organizations that there is absolutely no torture going on or violation of human rights. And the United States consistently and always complies with the international Geneva Accords in regards to the treatment of prisoners, prisoners of war. The problem is that these individuals that are being held in Guantanamo are individuals that are, it's very factual, were actively planning or plotting to kill innocent people, whether in European cities or to try to do it in the United States. And the question remains is, how's the best way to make sure that these individuals aren't just released and allowed to plan their next terrorist attack in one of the European cities? And we're working with the international community to try to find the best way in terms of dealing with this. And unfortunately, these terrorists many times are without countries of origin or operate without borders, and so it really needs to have an international consensus on what to do to prevent them from carrying out the attacks that they attempted to carry out, for instance, in London just last week.
Okay, how would you define the salient challenges the world is facing on justice, freedom, and security?
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
How would you define the main challenges that the world is facing on justice, freedom, and security? What are the issues that need to be dealt with by the world to see through that we have justice, that we have freedom and security?
Well, I think working multilaterally with countries through diplomacy as the main way to try to move as many countries as possible where they do have a democracy in place that empowers people, that values human rights and equal opportunity and liberty, and has a very strong rule of law. And history has shown us that this is critically important, not only to reduce war and conflict, but also to reduce human suffering. But in today's global community, those are the obvious threats mm-hmm. that we face. And for instance, there's lots of examples where the international community is working strongly together, whether it's through the quartet to find a two-state solution for Israel and Palestine mm-hmm. in the Middle East, or through the United Nations Security Council in dealing with ensuring that Iran does not develop nuclear weapons. But there are many other not-so-obvious factors that are threatening democracy and freedom. These include climate change, mm-hmm. Poverty, HIV/AIDS, and health concerns on a pandemic level. And that is why the United States is also working so hard through whether it's aid or other solutions, like we're technology development for climate change, to try to address these real global concerns for this century. And as I said before, the United States is giving now $30 billion to fight HIV and malaria in Africa, because Africa really cannot become prosperous and democratic unless you address those pandemic health concerns that are tearing that country apart or that continent apart. And then also collectively working on climate change and reducing CO2 emissions, which eventually could threaten stability if we don't address.
I was actually going to pick on this environment issue, because it's nowadays, even though I may sound cynical, it seems to be trendy to speak about environment. We hear this by politicians all the time. And it is, in a way, a popularity catcher. So I'd like to pick up on the core issues. What is the USA doing? Can you expand a bit on that? You've been criticized because of Kyoto. I mean, we've heard this debate a lot, but I'm more interested in what America is doing because I had the opportunity to speak to one of your colleagues, one of your staff, recently, and we did talk about Kyoto and not Kyoto, but I'm more interested in what is America doing about the environment?
Well, I'd love to share that with you because I think there are a lot of misconceptions based on Kyoto. First, let me just address that. The United States made the decision not to sign the Kyoto Protocol for two really important reasons. Number one, it left out some of the major polluters in the world, China, India, and Brazil. And if you don't have an agreement that addresses them, it's not going to get to the overall problem of CO2 emissions, which is a global problem. The second thing is that the approach was very heavy on mandates as opposed to incentives and technology development, which the United States favored. The good news is that the results are in since Kyoto was debated. And since from 2000 to 2004, according to the United Nations, the United States is now one of the leading reducers of CO2 emissions. We've been able to reduce our CO2 emissions by about a growth of 1.7%, where the EU as a whole has been able to reduce theirs to 2.8%. So the United States is doing extremely well. What's the reason for this? The reason is number one, this administration put in about $29 billion into technology development, both domestically and technology development to share worldwide. And this has come up with new alternative sources of energy that are now being put into practice, and also certain tax credits and incentives, which prompt both the American population but also the private sector to look at alternative uses of energy. Recently, President Bush, in his State of the Union address last January, announced that the United States a program to move the United States to reducing its dependence on gasoline by 20% in the next 10 years. That's significant.
And that's a target.
It's a target, yes, but there's also
strategies,
policies in place in order to get there along the lines of actually a combination of all three, mandates, incentives, tax credits. So I believe the United States absolutely will get there. President Bush also has been very forthcoming with sharing technology with other countries. One example is we put forward a program in China, which is one of the biggest emitters right now of CO2, to help them build new clean-burning coal plants. And this has been extremely successful. And to date, there's been three new clean coal-burning plants developed through this joint cooperation in China. As well, President Bush just submitted to the G8 conference held last month the idea of signing a new agreement by the end of 2008 to put in place targets and a global plan that includes everybody, including the developing countries like China, India, and Brazil, to reduce globally CO2 emissions. So I'm very pleased that the United States is not only taking a leadership role domestically to reduce its own CO2 emissions and is now one of the leaders in the world in doing that, but is also working globally as a leader to help other countries around the world and to work internationally to address this real global concern and challenge.
Ambassador, just a bit of a side issue. How come your answers are so clear and so fluent and so, and yet somehow this is not what we get through the media, you know what I mean? So somehow the way America is being interpreted, either via the media or I don't know, makes it, well, we tend to demonize a bit America as well. So why do you think this happens? Why do you think this is the case?
Well, that's really
out of my relations.
You're asking really a question that should be directed at the media, and that's out of my level of expertise. But I mean, I think today there's so many different sources of media that I can absolutely say that what I've been talking about is addressed in certain parts of the media. But there are so many sources of media, whether it's through the internet or through radio or through TV or through newspaper, that really this is the first time in today's age we've had so many diverse presence of media outlets that there is an opportunity for those to read media that just really backs up their own beliefs as opposed to creating critical thought. So I always encourage people to read as much different media and diverse media as possible so that it really can challenge even their own beliefs, which in the end creates the whole, you know, world and global community to be more open-minded.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I hope this program is contributing to that.
I hope so.
The USA, as far as military engagement is concerned, has been involved in loads, in Yugoslavia, Somalia, Liberia, the Philippines, Afghanistan. The list goes on. How come, there are two little questions here, how come this country feels this responsibility to be involved in conflicts which may not be directly in the interests of the USA? And as a parent, how does it feel knowing that America is sending 18, 19, 20-year-old soldiers in very hot spots for being involved in areas that are not really in the USA's interests.
Can you name those countries
of
conflict again,
well,
please?
Yes, I've mentioned a couple here. Yugoslavia, Somalia, Liberia, Philippines, Iraq, Afghanistan.
Right. The reason I asked you to do that is because we all know as a global community that those were countries that were under oppressive, brutal regimes that were, in the case of Yugoslavia, committing genocide, killing people based on their religious beliefs, or dictatorships, brutal dictatorships that were killing people because of their political beliefs. Extreme human rights violations that really tore apart the fabric of a peaceful global society. And the United States really supports the ability for countries, from a human rights standpoint, to become democracies, to help where we can, to remove oppressive, brutal dictatorships who are killing individuals because of religious, political, or other beliefs. And, of course, it is the main goal of the United States, wherever possible, to do this diplomatically. And that has always been the goal of the United States, and to work within the international community to do that diplomatically. But in some cases, for instance, the case in Yugoslavia, where the United States did stay out of it for a long time, and was hopeful that it could be achieved diplomatically, yet it was very difficult to stand by and watch so many individuals being murdered and slaughtered because of their religious beliefs, and the threat that it could spread into greater conflict throughout Europe and create potentially greater destabilization throughout the world. We also can never lose sight of the fact that we are truly a global community now, and whether it's our commerce or trade, so much of this type of potential international conflict does disrupt the entire global community. And so as a last resort, where diplomacy absolutely is not working, the United States has used military force to remove oppressive dictatorships, never to dominate or to stay in a country. Mm. Our goal when we went into Yugoslavia through NATO and led that operation was not to stay, but to create a stable government where then the people could leave and live in freedom and peace. And that was successful in Yugoslavia, which is now Kosovo and Bosnia and Macedonia and are now moving to become part of the EU even. And certainly this is the case in Afghanistan, where the Taliban was removed and then the Afghanistan people held free elections and formed their own government and decided what type of constitution to have and decided what type of government. And I believe will be successful and already are achieving great democratic quantum leaps forward, like what I discussed earlier, the ability for women for the first time to be educated, to have a life, to have a career, to not live in fear of being killed. And certainly Iraq is probably one of the hardest ones that we're facing, both as the United States and as an international community through our through everyone that's involved in Iraq. But it's important nonetheless to give the Iraqi people an opportunity to live freely. And so once again, the United States is there in a supportive role. And the Iraqi people have held elections three times to select their own constitution, elect their own government officials. And now we're trying to help them through training, through funding and other ways to develop their own rule of law and judicial system, which you're talking about a country that didn't have rule of law and judicial system, a fair and equal one, and also security forces to maintain their own security. And it's our desire, it's President Bush's desire, to be able to bring our troops home as soon as possible. But it's really important that that doesn't take place until the Iraqis truly can independently take care of a lot of these issues. So we're there in a supportive role, and we're there now at the request of the Iraqi government as a sovereign country. We recognize that. And if they asked us to leave, we would definitely leave. So we're still there at their request. Mm-hmm. In response to your last question,
yes.
I mean, it goes without saying, it's heartbreaking when any American loses their life. In the United States, we have a pure voluntary army and voluntary military. So everybody who is serving in Iraq or serving in the United States military does so voluntarily. And it's an amazing thing that these brave, brave young men and women not only are concerned about freedom and security in the United States and globally, but when they're actually serving in Iraq and you talk to them, because we actually have Marines at the embassy that have come back from Iraq, how much they care for the Iraqi people. And from a human-to-human standpoint, just really caring about that ability for another human being to have freedom and lack of tyranny.
How would you imagine the world without the USA or without the USA in this type of role? Some would say they would have a better deal. Others would say probably not.
I think history really speaks volumes about that, whether it's, you know, going back to World War II, where how different would Europe be today without the United States? Mm. Extremely different. Not only did the United States help free Europe from the tyranny of a dictator, but then helped rebuild it financially through the Marshall Plan. And then during the threat of the Soviet Union was the main catalyst to make sure that the Soviet Union didn't expand its power into Europe. And today is trying to do just the same, to try to help countries with the desire to become democracies and the desire to become free, to build themselves both politically and economically to be more prosperous. And I think clearly history shows that if the United States, the world without the United States, it would be probably a world with a lot more conflict, a lot more wars, a lot more oppression, a lot more genocide, a lot more killing.
Children being abducted, an ongoing risk of being blown to pieces if you go on holiday. What once was a thrilling experience going on a plane and traveling is now becoming the longest 3 hours of your life. Removing all the mirrorness here at this point, I mean, aren't you preoccupied with what we are going to pass on to our children, with the inheritance we are giving to our children? You know, is the world basically a safer place to live in, and is it becoming a safer place to live in, or is it becoming a much more challenging experience than ever to live in?
Well, there's no question if you look at a historical standpoint, the world is a much safer place. There are less conflicts and wars today than there were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, certainly 50 and 60 years ago when World War II was ravaging most of the European continent and Malta as well, where it wasn't just necessarily where someone would have a fear of getting on a plane, which I certainly don't, but just leaving your house. So the world, there's no question, is a safer place today. I think certainly people in the United States have a greater sense of security today since September 11th because of the actions that the President Bush and his administration have taken to ensure that another attack like that does not take place again. And there's so many concrete examples where it's been working internationally on terrorist financing and to try to stop the avenues of terrorist financing, dismantling the terrorist organizations a lot of times through the financing mechanism. Also, being able countries to communicate better and share information. And certainly there are things like having to put in place procedures at airports, which are more annoying than anything. But at least the American public for now is okay with going through a more annoying procedure to board a flight, feeling safer once they are on the flight. So I don't think that there is definitely, I would say in the United States there is not a preoccupation with this, but a sense of responsibility to do what we need to do to make sure that these terrorists aren't able to attack innocent people. But to then allow American people or people throughout the world to go on with their daily lives and enjoy going to work, going to school, going to their child's first Holy Communion, like I got to do here in Malta with my six-year-old daughter, and or to my child's birthday party, and celebrate all the wonderful rites of passage in your life. And I think the majority of Americans definitely would say that that's how they spend their days and months and years.
Okay. The last one.
Okay.
From here to where? You have a year or so left in this appointment. Where do you see yourself after that?
Oh, my gosh. the one role I always know that I will always have, and probably my most important role, is being a mom and a wife. So no matter what, when we leave in a year, I'll go back, and I like to always say I'll be driving my kids to school and to soccer matches, or you say football matches, mm-hmm. and ballet and everything else. But I will probably return to the private sector in some way or fashion, probably in commercial real estate development, although I have a great passion in developing green buildings, which I was doing right before I left. One of the partnerships that I was involved in got one of the highest certifications for the redevelopment of a historical building. So I would like to do something like that. And I think I'll always be involved in politics because I have this desire to contribute to make the world and community, or maybe just my neighborhood, a better place. So I think
we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
Well,
as will I.
Thank you very much. As anticipated, this was a really stimulating dialogue. I really enjoyed myself. I would like to thank Ambassador Bordenaro for making time for this show. I would also like to show my appreciation to your colleagues, Ms. Joanne Zingarello and Mr. Jeff Anderson, for their professional and assiduous assistance in coordinating the logistics. I would also like to thank the listeners for being there, obviously my colleagues here at Campus FM, and I really look forward to another program next week.
Meeting points. Meeting points.